Blumont sounded.
What did they call it? Sexting or something like that to a woman inside R.
He shook his head.
So now we are here, Bob said, looking back to the west. The snow's clearing for a moment. Go ahead and take a look. It's just to the left of that ski slope. That's Site R, just over there. You can see the antenna array atop the mountain.
John squinted and looked to where Bob was pointing, and sure enough, he could see the antennas jutting up from atop a ridgeline as a snow squall drifted clear for a moment. Wouldn't those antennas have fried off on the day? Maury asked.
Yes, but for a place like that, they have backups and more backups stored inside. Remember, it was built to come through a nuclear war. If that place is somehow operational, they got the replacements up. So that is why I decided we should park here, eavesdrop in the best way possible, with our gear literally aimed straight at them from only 6 miles away. I knew this to be as good a spot as any to do so, and figured we'd soak up a little history as well while my tech boys listen in. Feel free to wander around, but don't go out into the open. I doubt anyone picked us up flying in 20 feet off the road for the last 50 miles, but one can never be positive, especially when coming up on a place like this. So, now we sit back, wait for my team to get up and running, and see if this is a wild goose chase or not.
And if it is a wild goose chase? Kevin Mullady asked, looking over at Bob suspiciously. Bob sighed.
Let's just hope this is the final straw, he said coldly, his tension obvious to all.
Let's take a look around, John announced, working to ease that tension down. If this was indeed a wild goose chase, what would his friend do next? For that matter, John now wondered, what would he do with whatever it was he was about to find? John felt it best to step back for a few minutes. He motioned for his friends to follow and set off along the crest of the hill. He cautioned all to remain inside the woodline while pointing out the statue of General Gouverneur Warren, hero of the Battle of Gettysburg, his bronze figure forever gazing toward where the Confederate attack had come in. Near Warren's iconic statue, the gaudy and imposing two-story-high mini castle dedicated as a monument to a New York regiment towered above them, which John suggested they not climb up. He noticed that Bob was following along. Bob's features were drawn, pale in spite of the icy blasts of wind whipping about the hilltop. What is he contemplating next? John wondered.
Wish we had time to really visit this place, Bob said. Maybe when better times come again, we will do so.
In the silence of a winter morning, the landscape clad in snow, visibility at times dropping as another squall came in like powder smoke obscuring this field of action, John felt a strong, profound connection with this land and its history. With all that had happened, would history eventually forget this place, its location returning to primordial forest, such as what greeted the first settlers 100 years before the battle? It was a sobering thought that a day might come when their descendants, a score, maybe even 100 generations hence, might walk this ground, look at the broken fragments of long-gone monuments, and ask, "What happened here?" Already the first signs of neglect were showing. The once heavily trodden pathways were beginning to be reclaimed by the forest. Looters and vandals had already defaced many of the monuments, stealing the bronze plaques emblazoned with the names of the gallant for their metal. Even a couple of the artillery barrels had been stolen from their cast-iron gun carriages. The path led down the slope to a simple granite monument tucked into the southwest slope of the hill. John, with his friend Bob by his side, approached it reverently. It was the monument for the 20th Maine, which had held the extreme left flank of the Union Army on that grim, terrible day against odds as high as 6-1. Even Lee Robinson, whose ancestors had assaulted this hill, stood in reverent silence as John spoke a few words about what this place meant to him, how the commander of that regiment, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, when returning years later to this now quiet glen, declared that where great deeds are accomplished, greatness lingers, and that this was indeed the vision place of souls. All stood silent, Bob then offering that they pray together for the repose of the souls of all who fell here, both north and south, which they did, Lee openly in tears. As the group turned to start back up the slope, General Scales interrupted their departure.
"It might be legend, it might be true," he began, struggling to keep control over his voice. "Some claim that when the few hundred men of Maine who were sent to hold this position started to dig in, piling up rocks to form a low wall to huddle against, and hearing a tidal wave of thousands screaming the rebel yell heading their way, Colonel Chamberlain stepped forward to address his men. Back then, officers actually did that kind of thing. Legend is that he cried out, 'Men of Maine,' and then went on to proclaim that perhaps only once in a century were so few men gifted to hold such responsibility, that whether their republic lived or died now rested in their hands, and their hands alone, and let each man embrace that duty, if need be, with his life. Maybe that is us this day," Bob said. "The republic might rest in our hands before this day is out."
With that, he turned and started back up to the crest, shoulders braced back, walking with a purposeful stride. John followed in his wake, sensing that his friend had reached a profound decision. As they reached the crest of the hill, Sergeant Major Bentley, who had stayed behind, came racing down to meet the group.
"My God, General, you gotta see this."
Bob moved ahead swiftly, and this time Bentley did not hesitate to put his arm around his respected commander and help him up the slope. John fell in behind them as they reached the crest. The two snipers were hunkered down behind the boulders, and the antenna arrays had been covered with gauzy white camouflage netting, one of the snipers forcefully suggesting that the rest of the group stay low.
"We monitored a Black Hawk taking off from there not 10 minutes ago," Bentley announced. "It was a tense moment, feared it might be coming over this way to check us out. But it turned southeast, and from the chatter we picked up, it was bound for Bluemont."
"Okay, and?" Bob asked.
"My God, sir, that place is bursting with chatter, uplinking to a sat. Take a look."
Bob went over to where his two surveillance people were hunched over their laptops, capturing data. One of the surveillance team looked up at Bob, but he wasn't grinning, and there was a chilling, icy look of rage in his eyes and clarity in his tone of voice.
"Sir, those bastards."
He paused for a moment.
"Those people over there, the flow is near constant. The stuff going up, not much and highly encrypted, but we can break some of it down. It is the other traffic, though. Personal notes to people back at Bluemont."
"Personal? One of them complaining that they're sick of the friggin' rations."
The young man looked down at the ground and slammed his fist next to the laptop he was monitoring.
"They're complaining about the food they're stuffing themselves with while I found out my father was killed trying to protect our family dog from being taken for food, and my mother was—"
His voice trailed off into tears of rage. Bob squatted down by his side, rubbing the back of the young man's neck, but as he did so, he looked at the data scrolling down on the screen, eavesdropping on transmissions from Site R, but 6 miles away. He remained thus for long minutes, at one point picking up the laptop and asking the other technician how to freeze the screen so he could reread something. As he did, his features reddened, and he put the laptop down and stood up.
"Okay, we've got enough here," he snapped sharply. "I want you two to stay here and keep monitoring. Capture everything you can."
He then looked back at the two who were the security detail and ordered them to stay as well, along with one to follow him back to the choppers and pull out some survival gear and rations, and then come back. He now looked at John and the others.
"Let's go," he snarled.
"To where?" Bob pointed across the fields of Gettysburg to the ridgeline beyond.
"We're going to take that damn hill."
Chapter 16. A thunder echoed in the valley behind Little Round Top as the 5 Apaches and 8 Black Hawks started to rev up. General Scales had gathered his men around once back down from the hilltop and briefed all on what was to be done. Standing with his friends,
It struck John just how concisely the man had thought out a tactical plan within a matter of minutes. He outlined the reasons for his decision first and offered that if any did not want to participate, they were free to stay behind. Upon hearing what the general had to say, every man and woman volunteered, all filled with a deep anger. Next, he laid out the tactical plan for the assault to the pilots and troops and, having caught his breath after the grueling hike in the snow, did so with a calm radiance and voice of authority. As he broke word to his command of exactly what they were facing, and that they were going straight in, John could see the entire demeanor of the 80 troops, the pilots and co-pilots, shift within seconds to determination and bitter rage. Many of them cursed foully as they gathered round their choppers and geared up for a flight into what might turn into a hot zone, zipping up Kevlar jackets and loading up with extra ammunition from the boxes hauled in on the helicopter John had ridden in. The medics were tearing open the box of supplies carried on John's chopper, each of them shouldering several fully loaded emergency bags, checking to make sure they had medic armbands on both arms. Forrest quietly whispered to John that in Afghanistan the medics took those off, since the bastards they were fighting would single out medics for special treatment. Once loaded up, Bob circled to each team, bowed his head, and led them in a short prayer before helping them to load in. Bob chose to go in with the lead copter, telling the pilot for the one John was on to hang back and be the last one to come in once the LZ was cleared.
"This is why I wanted you and your friends with us," Bob shouted. "If we find what I suspect is over there, I want civilian witnesses. You might not know it, John, but your reputation extends beyond just Black Mountain, Montreat, and Nashville. So if things get hot, you are to stay back and stay alive. You got that?"
Bob led this last group in a short prayer with heads bowed, and he shook hands. He told Forrest and Milady, who was a Marine vet, to make sure everyone's gear was squared away, and then stomped off to the lead chopper.
"Let's double-check each other's equipment and get ready for some shit," Forrest shouted enthusiastically,
and John could see that in a perverse way, PTSD was forgotten for the moment. He was back in his old element and enjoying it. As each climbed into the chopper, Forrest and Milady checked their Kevlar jackets and helmet straps, Forrest giving John an admonishing look as he zipped up John's jacket and then helped him up while Kevin double-checked that each was properly strapped into their safety harness.
"It could be hot. We might get hit. If we do and have to ditch in, follow what I do," Kevin shouted.
Their pilot looked back over his shoulder, holding up one hand in a thumbs-up gesture, which all returned.
"Bugler, sound charge!"
Forrest shouted as they lifted off, this time rising nearly vertically, the Black Hawks spacing out into line astern with Bob and the lead Black Hawk, while two Apaches fanned out onto either flank, the other three moving ahead of the column. John looked over at Lee, who was sitting next to him, his gaze fixed forward, and for once he did not look nauseous. They swung a bit to the north, following the Wheatfield Road rather than cresting up over Little Round Top. Lee, wide-eyed, rattled over the place names, Wheatfield, the Peach Orchard, Trossel Farm, his voice filled with emotion. John recalled years ago at the town's Civil War round table meeting, when Lee had nervously presented a talk on his family's role in the war, how two of his ancestors fought in this battle, one losing an arm. There were tears in his eyes as he leaned up to take in the view.
"If only we had half a dozen of these at that battle, good God, how it would have changed things!"
"Suppose we had them instead," John quipped back with a smile. The choppers swept low over the snow-covered battlefield, hugging the earth, climbing up the gentle slope of Seminary Ridge, pitching up slightly to just barely clear the trees. Ahead, Sachs-covered bridge could be seen, beyond that the open fields of the Eisenhower farm, and then directly ahead, Site R, the ridgetop, bristling with antennas. Lee took a deep breath and looked across at Forrest, who was sitting silently, eyes half closed.
"How bad is it going to be?" Lee shouted.
"Don't know. Maybe just some garrison types who will pee themselves and run as we come in, or special ops types with orders to shoot to kill anyone who comes close and tear us apart as we come in. You'll know in about 3 minutes."
"Now I know how my granddaddy's felt."
Lee sighed, his features set and grim. He started to whisper, and John caught bits of the 91st Psalm, which many called the soldier's psalm, "Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor the arrow that flieth by day, nor the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor the destruction that wasteth by noonday."
"Minute out!" the pilot shouted. "Doesn't look hot. We circled while the others touched down first."
John strained up to try to catch a glimpse. The mountain filled the windscreen before them, the pilot pitching up slightly to clear space beneath him for the Apaches that were already skimming along the face of the ridgeline. There was a paved runway at the base of the ridgeline, John noting that it had been cleared of snow. Between the airfield and the ridge, there were a half a dozen helipads, cleared and marked as well. A Black Hawk rested on one of the pads. So far, no shots were fired. The Apaches zoomed back and forth along the face of the mountain as the chopper with Bob in it skimmed in low, flared up, and touched down on one of the pads. Bob was the first one out before it had even settled down, followed by troopers with weapons raised. Another came in, and then a third, while a couple of hundred feet up, the Black Hawk that John was in turned in sharp 60-degree banks, circling about. Lee, absolutely wired up, for once did not complain while Forrest, chuckling softly, hung on to his safety harness with one hand, M4 strapped across his chest.
"Shit, we've got incoming!"
the pilot shouted, and he snapped the Black Hawk over into an opposite turn. For a few seconds it looked to John as if he was about to go straight into the mountain before pulling around. John caught a glimpse down and saw that a firefight was opening up, tracers arcing back and forth between where the Black Hawks were landing and bunkers set to either side of what appeared to be a massive steel door, at least 30 feet wide and 20 feet high. What appeared to be orange tennis balls snapped past the Black Hawk's windshield, the pilot cursing and going into sharp, spiraling, evasive turns.
"I'm putting us down before we get hit up here,"
the pilot shouted, and he nosed nearly straight down. The helicopter pads were now all occupied by the Black Hawks, John's pilot opting for an access road, plowed as well, that circled round the pads. He flared up sharply, the medic that was flying with them reaching up to slide a side door open. Even before touching down, he was shouting for them to get out, stay low, and hit the ground. Forrest was the first up, and in spite of his old war injuries, was out the door. He ran half a dozen feet and flung himself to the ground, M4 up and ready to engage. John had not done anything like this in more than 20 years, but training did kick in, as it did for Milady and even Maury, who leaped out and sprawled into the snow alongside Forrest. John looked back and saw Lee standing in the open doorway, Grace behind him.
"Lee! Grace! Get out!"
John shouted, and at that instant, a burst of shots laced down the side of the helicopter, shattering its forward windshield, hitting the pilot, and then stitching across Lee. He collapsed back into the Black Hawk, the long burst raking down the length of the helicopter, tearing across the turbine housings, and from there into the tail rotor, which disintegrated into deadly shards arcing out in every direction. Smoke billowed out between the still rotating rotor blades. John got to his feet and ran back even as the medic was grabbing hold of Lee, pulling him feet first out of the crippled bird. There was blood covering Grace's face, but she was up, helping to push Lee out, John grabbing hold of his friend's legs and pulling him to safety. His friend was wide-eyed and gasping. It looked as if his vest had taken a shot, and for a few seconds John thought he had just been stunned by the blow, turning to Grace and shouting at her if she was wounded.
"I don't think I'm hit,"
she cried. He then looked back at Lee, who at that instant started to cough up blood. The medic frantically tore the Kevlar jacket open, cursing. There was an entry wound that had punched through his jacket just above his heart. The medic rolled Lee up onto his side, slipped his hand down the back, and came up with a bloody hand.
"Damn it!"
the medic cried, and he looked at Grace, who had been standing behind Lee in the helicopter, her face splattered with blood.
"You hit?" "No, not sure. No." "Then put pressure on Lee's wound,"
the medic shouted, pushing down hard with his own hands first, and then grabbing Grace's hand and guiding her to take over. He looked back to the front of the chopper. The pilot was staggering out, arm drenched with blood, co-pilot running around the front of the Black Hawk to help him get clear. The medic returned his focus to Lee. John knelt beside Lee, not sure what to do other than hold his old friend's hand. The medic was cutting through Lee's parka and shirt underneath, stabbing the exposed arm with a serrette of morphine, and seconds later the look of panic in Lee's eyes cleared a bit, while the medic worked frantically to set up a bag of plasma.
"What's his name?"
the medic cried, looking over at John. "Lee Robinson. The medic leaned down close to Lee's face. "Lee, you are going to make it, but you've got to stay with me. I've got to keep you breathing. I'm going to work a breathing and suction tube down you. Don't panic. You got that? Stay with me. I'm going to get you through this." Lee looked around wide-eyed, gaze resting on John.
"Gettysburg. Good place to die, my friend."
"You're not dying, Lee," John cried. Lee coughed up more blood.
"Thought we'd share being grandfathers together. Tell them I love them."
He started to convulse. The medic gave up on the breathing tube for a moment, pulling Grace's bloody hands aside and actually slipping a couple of fingers into the entry wound.
"Jesus, God,"
the medic whispered softly, and then he leaned back, reached into the tote bag dangling from his shoulder, pulled it open, and drew out an emergency surgical pack. "I've got to try to go in," the medic announced. "Stop the bleeding there." He unrolled the pack beside Lee, and then drew out another morphine syringe and stuck it into Lee's arm. John looked at him, questioning this decision. "I've got to all but knock him out," the medic snapped, before John could even ask. All this time, gunfire was snapping around them, several shots stitching up the snow within feet of where the medic was working. He looked back over his shoulder. "Damn you, you sons of bitches! Can't you see I'm a damn medic?" he cried. Lee was still frothing up blood. His lungs were clogging with aspirated blood, the medic whispering for Grace to cover her friend's eyes and keep reassuring him. She began to sob as she leaned over him and started to whisper calming words that he would make it. Another convulsion tore through Lee's body, blood spraying up out of his mouth in a torrent. And then he just started to relax. The medic leaned back and said nothing, lowering his head. Lee looked up at John and actually appeared to smile.
"Gettysburg. Bury me here, John."
And then he was gone. John could only kneel beside his friend of so many years, holding his hand, finger resting on his pulse, feeling the last faint beat, and he was gone. All he could do was lean over, embrace his friend, and cry.
"Matherson!" he looked up.
It was Sergeant Major Bentley, gesturing for him to come forward. John ignored him for the moment, looking back to the medic. It was 50 caliber, most likely. Kevlar won't stop that. Felt like his aorta was nicked, pulmonary arteries shot up as well. He stared at Lee for a moment and then turned to look at the pilot, who was crouched down next to him, blood pouring down his arm. "Let's take care of that," the medic said, and he turned away, as if Lee had never existed.
"Damn it, Matherson, on me!"
Again it was Bentley. John forced himself to stand up and then paused, leaned back over, and closed his friend's eyes. Grace was kneeling by the body, crying.
"Grace, stay here with the medic. You can help him."
"I'm going with you," she snapped sharply. "Damn it, I'm not losing you too, Grace. Now stay here with the medic. He needs you more than I do."
"Stay here, Grace. I need you," the medic ordered, even as he tore away the sleeve of the wounded pilot to reveal arterial blood pulsing out.
"Matherson, damn it, the general wants you. Move it!"
John looked back to where Bentley was standing out in the open, arms on hips, as if oblivious to the firefight that was going on. John spared one last glance for his fallen friend, stifled back his emotions, and crouching low started toward Bentley. Maury, Forrest, and Milady, who had been deployed forward, got up to join him.
"Lee?"
Maury asked.
"Gone,"
was all he could choke out. A loud tearing sound, almost like that of a bedsheet being ripped in half, echoed against the face of the ridge. One of the Apaches, angled down, was at a hover 50 feet up, pouring in a stream of 30-millimeter shells across the face of the huge steel doors, then turning its fire into a bunker on one flank for several seconds, pivoting, delivering the same deadly blow to the second bunker on the other side of the door. Its tracer rounds made its efforts look like a garden hose of liquid fire pouring down from an angry heaven. A second Apache was swinging back and forth, sweeping the ground above the door with the same river of death. There was a secondary explosion from what must have been a concealed bunker positioned partway up the steep slope. John came up to Bentley, who, without comment, turned, set off at a slow jog, and led them to where General Scales was down on one knee, snapping out commands into the handheld radio.
"That's it. You've torn the shit out of them," he cried. "We take one more shot. Don't wait for me. Cut loose again."
The two Apaches broke away from their attacks, turned, and with rotors thumping loudly, pivoted and climbed up. Bob stood, went over to a Black Hawk, and held up his hand, and the pilot offered him a microphone linked to a loudspeaker strapped to the helicopter.
"That's it," Bob shouted. "We didn't want a fight. You opened fire first. You saw what you got. Lay down your arms, come out hands over your heads, and I promise safe surrender. You've got 30 seconds or some hellfires will come in next."
The bunker to the left flank of the steel door let go with a secondary explosion, ammunition within lighting off like a long string of firecrackers, men around Bob ducking. He remained standing.
15 seconds or you'll really get a taste of hell.
Three men came staggering out of the second bunker, hands up, one of them obviously burned, smoke swirling up from his scorched uniform.
"Medic forward," Bob shouted. "Surrender. We'll take care of the wounded. This is General Bob Scales, Eastern Command. I am giving you a direct order that will save your lives. Now give it up!"
One of Bob's medics raced forward and actually knocked the man in the smoldering uniform down, rolling him back and forth in the snow and shouting for one of the other surrendering men to help him. The sight of this finally broke the standoff at last. More men and women began to emerge from concealment, many of them wounded.
"That's it. Keep coming forward," Bob shouted. "All medics up front and center. Treatment center on me. Move it!"
The Apaches continued to circle overhead like birds of prey eager to strike. Looking up, Bob picked the transmission mic up, clicked it, and passed the order for them to climb a bit higher, hover, and hold fire unless directly ordered to attack. He let the mic drop, grimly surveying those coming in, and then looked over at John.
"Thank God you're okay," he said. "I looked back when your bird was hit. I thought it was you in the doorway."
"It was my friend Lee," John replied, still struggling with emotion. Bob looked at him questioningly. "He's dead." Muttering a curse, Bob turned away.
"Damn them. Damn them. There was no need for this. I had to come in sharp and fast, not just go up to the gate and knock politely and ask to please come in. But it didn't have to be this way. Damn fool should have seen we had the firepower, Edge."
Several dozen surrendering were now coming forward, the majority injured in some way. A captain, dragging a wounded leg, approached Bob and stopped half a dozen feet away and just glared at him.
"Who the hell are you?"
the captain snapped.
"First off, I am your superior officer, and you will salute before addressing me," Bob snapped.
The captain glared at him and those around him, attention focusing on John and his people for a moment, who, other than their flak jackets and helmets, were decidedly unmilitary.
"And this rabble?"
Sergeant Bentley stepped forward and got within inches of the captain's face. "You will address the general as sir, you son of a bitch, and salute a superior officer. Now close your damn yap and answer when spoken to." The captain began to reply, and Bentley leaned in almost nose to nose, exactly like a professional DI intimidating a jerk of a recruit who, if behind the barracks and out of sight, would get his butt kicked. The captain relented, stepping backward a few paces and to one side, turning his focus toward the general, and finally offered a salute. "Captain Dean Hansen, United States Air Force." Bob barely returned the salute.
"Your unit?"
223rd Security Battalion.
"Oh, Christ, Air Force Security," one of the men behind Bob growled. "No wonder."
Bob did not look back at whoever spoke out with disdain.
"Why did you fire on us, Captain?"
Bob snapped.
"Sir, our standing orders are anyone enters this compound, we shoot first and ask questions later."
Bob looked around at the carnage. Lee was not the only casualty on their side. Several men near Bob were down. Dead and wounded were being carried in where one of the medics was shouting that he was setting up a clearing area, literally next to the command Black Hawk. The ship John was in was beginning to burn, and no one was bothering to try to suppress it.
"Now listen to my orders," Bob snapped at the captain. "That steel door over there, open it now."
The captain stiffened and shook his head. "My name is Captain Dean Hansen, United States Air Force, serial number."
Bob stepped closer.
"Cut the bullshit, Captain. Open the damn door."
"Sir, what you were ordering is in direct contradiction to my orders."
"From where?"
"Sir, I do not have to answer that question."
"Bluemont!"
Bob shouted, and John saw a flicker in the captain's eyes, and he knew Bob saw it as well. Bob shoved past the captain and strode the 100 yards to the door, ducking down for a moment as more munitions from one of the bunkers ignited like a 4th of July display. A dozen of Bob's troopers and John and his friends fell in behind him. As they approached the vast steel door, They could see it looked almost like a safe, its face pockmarked from the strafing runs by the Apaches that still circled overhead.
"Captain, open that door," Bob said, looking back at Hansen, whom Bentley was shoving along behind them.
"I can't." "What do you mean you can't?"
"The control mechanism was inside the bunker you just destroyed." There was an edge of triumphant sarcasm to his voice. John looked at the captain with unconcealed hatred. In a world of starvation, those like Hansen stood out. He was full-fleshed, actually overweight, face round and florid, obviously spending more time sitting in a comfortable office, 3 good meals a day, and not out scrounging for enough calories to struggle through one more day.
"Bullshit," Bob snapped. "There's always a backup. Something like this, no idiot built it with only one way to open the door. You've got a backup."
"My name is Captain Dean Hansen." The captain's words were cut short by a scream of panic as he ducked down, falling to his knees, Sergeant Bentley with an old-style 1911 45 semi-auto standing over him, having discharged the weapon only inches from his head.
"Next one will be to the head in 30 seconds if you don't answer the general," Bentley said.
The captain looked up at Bentley, obviously terrified, and then looked to Bob. And then there was actually a bit of a smile.
"Screw you. I know you. You'd never execute one of your own," he snapped, but his voice was quavering.
Bob glared at him, all around them silent. John took it all in and knew the captain was right. Bob was trying to bluff him, and the captain knew it. Though they had come all this way, that steel barrier blocked them from the answer they sought. There was only one way out, John realized. He stepped forward and went up to Bentley.
"Give me that pistol," he snapped.
Bentley looked back to his general, who gave a subtle nod of agreement. John took the pistol, stepped in front of Hansen, and leveled the weapon straight at his forehead.
"Now listen very carefully, you son of a bitch," John said, his voice icy cold. "My name is John Matherson. For a year, I was military commander of my community down in the mountains of North Carolina. Do you hear me, Dean?"
There was no response. "I am not part of General Scales's command. I am here as a witness to whatever is behind that door. Less than a week after the shit hit the fan and everything went down, I put a bullet into the head of a thieving drug addict in a public execution. Do you hear me?" Again no response, but he could see the man was looking up at him wide-eyed. "I've personally executed dozens more since then without hesitation. 10 minutes ago, one of your bastards killed one of my closest friends. The blood on me is his blood. Do you read me?" There was a faint nod. "I've extended your life by 2 minutes. Maybe the general would not order you shot, but by heaven I have no such compunctions. I'm giving you 30 seconds to do as the general ordered. If you do not, I will blow your frigging head off and not hesitate. At this moment, I might blow it off anyhow as payback for my friend even after you answer, but your odds are better if you answer. After I shoot you, I'll single out another and another of the prisoners until someone finally gives the general the answer he wants. Now, Captain Hansen, do you read me?" He paused and looked around at those gathered, and then back at Hansen.
15 seconds, John snapped.
"John!"
He looked up. It was Scales who was shaking his head.
"Stay out of it, damn it!" John shouted. "We've been through hell for 2.5 years, and I want the answers now! Lee didn't die just for us to stand around like a bunch of assholes in front of a door this bastard can open!"
He looked back at Dean. 10 seconds.
8 seconds.
Several of the prisoners, obviously terrified, shouted for the captain to relent, one crying out that he knew the answer and would give it. John could see that the man had lost control, his trousers soaking through.
6 seconds.
He pressed the cold muzzle of the gun to the captain's forehead.
All right,
Dean screamed. I'll talk!
John nodded and stepped back, suddenly feeling completely drained.
Get him to open the door now, John commanded. If he doesn't open that door in 3 minutes, bring him back here and I'll kill him.
John walked back to Sergeant Bentley, easing the hammer of the .45 down to the safe position. He held the weapon by the muzzle, which was warm, and offered it back to the sergeant, who took it. Bentley stared him straight in the eyes. By God, sir, would you have done it? After all we've been through, John said, not answering the question. And, Sergeant, don't ever ask me that question again. A couple of troopers of Scales's command dragged Dean up to the door. He fumbled to open the collar of his uniform and drew out several keys on a chain around his neck, muttering that the electronic controls had been shot out. He handed one to a guard accompanying him, explaining that they both had to insert the keys in locks 10 feet apart and turn them simultaneously. They did so, and with a metallic hiss, the vast doorway cracked open. Bob stepped forward.
Hold it there, he shouted, and going up to Hansen's side. You got a security detail in there? He snapped.
A moment of hesitation.
You play us wrong now and I hand you back to my friend Matherson. Do you have a security detail inside?
Yes, sir.
Then you are in first and order them to stand down. I got a sniper aiming straight at your back. You play us false, and you will be the first to die, and I turn those outside over to Matherson and his men. You read me? If the killing is to stop now, it is up to you, Captain. I want any security to come out, weapons held overhead, or by God, I'll have an Apache outside this door pouring 30 millimeter and then a hellfire down inside.
It's over,
Hansen cried. Then make sure it is.
Hansen, shaking and barely able to walk, approached the front of the blast door, which had slid open just a few feet, hands held high over his head.
This is Captain Hansen. We are surrendering this facility to forces of Eastern Command. Safety your weapons and come out with them held over your heads.
John could hear voices from within arguing back and forth for several long, drawn-out minutes. Dean started to step into the cavernous darkness, but froze in place when Scales barked out an order for him to not take another step in, shouting loudly that he was General Scales, in charge of Eastern Command, and was taking control of this facility, and those who surrendered would be treated honorably. Dean, voice breaking, began to sob, crying out that it was over and for the detail within to come out as ordered. Finally, they began to emerge, and within minutes, half a hundred were out the door, dropping weapons as they emerged to be hustled off by a detail set up by Sergeant Bentley. Finally, there was no one left except Hansen partway into the half-open doors. Bob finally came up to his side.
How do we open these things wide?
Dean nodded to a control panel inside the doorway. Bob told him to go ahead. Dean entered a code, and the doors slid the rest of the way open. John watched this in angry silence. The doors must have weighed several dozen tons or more, and were at least 3 feet thick. 50 yards into the tunnel, there was another set of doors, not as substantial, but still significant, and for a second time, the same ritual was played out of cracking them open, Dean taking a few steps in, shouting for the security detail behind them to come out with weapons secured and surrender. It was a tense few minutes, with several of them refusing until Bob, with his excellent command voice, talked them down, that the entire firefight had been a tragic misunderstanding, and as he was commander of all troops east of the Appalachians, those within were under his command, to obey immediately or face court-martial. They finally surrendered.
Another security detail beyond here? Bob asked as he nodded down the wide, cavernous corridor carved out of solid rock, 3 lanes wide, illuminated every 100 feet or so by a dimly glowing fluorescent light set into the ceiling.
Just those off duty and everyone else?
Everyone else? John asked. Dean looked at him but said no more.
Get this bastard out of here, Bob snapped, looking back at Sergeant Bentley. All prisoners secured outside, all wounded regardless of side treated ASAP. I think 10 of our men can handle this rabble now that they've surrendered. I want the rest on me.
I want you with me as well, Sergeant, so get it squared away and then catch up.
Bob watched as Dean, staggering from shock, was led back into the brilliant midday light of the entrance.
Would you have done it?
Bob asked, looking at John. John just gazed at him, still feeling cold, nearly broken inside, wondering now what shock would confront him next. Bob put a reassuring hand on his shoulder.
We've all been through too much, he said, gesturing down the long tunnel. Let's see what's down there, and if this trip was worth the price.
Chapter 17.
It was a very long trip down, a hike of well over half a mile. John and those with him and Scales fell silent except for occasional whispers and Bob explaining this entire facility was carved out of solid rock and was not a natural cave. The road began to level out from its 5-degree pitch, the air within warmer so that parkas were unzipped. Bob cautioned those with him to keep their Kevlar jackets buttoned up tight and weapons held up in a non-threatening manner and to only return fire if fired upon first. A babble of voices began to echo. Shouts, cries, yells of confusion and fear. Bob ordered the main group to stop, and he sent several scouts ahead, again reminding them of orders not to shoot. Long minutes passed. Bob squatted down on the hard tarmac, reaching into a pocket and pulling out some hard candies from an open MRE pack and passing them around. As they waited, Bentley came up. There was a wordless exchange of glances, and it was an indicator to John that this officer and top NCO truly worked as a team, respected each other, and could work on instinct of mutual trust without a word being said. Bentley unclipped a flashlight from his vest, snapped it on, and continued down the tunnel until finally he was only a pinpoint of light. Several more minutes passed, and then all jumped with a start. A single shot, followed a second later by two more, echoed like a cannon in the cavernous hall, the flashlight snapping off.
"Son of a bitch!" Scales snapped. "Up, get ready to move. Weapons on safety, but be ready to engage if fired on."
The troopers with them began to move out, edging along either side of the tunnel. Bob gestured for John and those with him to hold back for a moment, passing a quiet order to the one medic who had come in with them to get against the wall and be ready to set up an aid station.
"I don't want a bloodbath," Scales announced. "If we find what I think we're about to find, I don't want a bloodbath."
They started forward, crouching low. A flashlight came back on down at the end of the corridor, blinked twice, and then, several seconds later, blinked 5 more times. Bob, unclipping his flashlight, repeated the signal back and came fully erect. The flashlight at the end of the corridor grew brighter, moving up and down, obviously held by someone walking toward them, shifting the high-intensity beam up toward the ceiling so as not to blind them. The troopers advancing ahead of John and those around him stopped in place. There were some whispered exchanges, and then Bentley came into view, illuminated by the dim overhead fluorescent lights, left hand holding his .45. In the pale light, John could see blood soaking his arm. He had his right hand firmly gripped to the collar of a civilian dressed in what was the nearly ubiquitous uniform of government officials of chinos and a blue dress shirt. The man was short next to Bentley, nearly bald, features heavy, looking back and forth nervously at the troopers who were poised to either side of the tunnel. Scales stood in place, not coming forward, John falling in by his side. A few more steps and Bentley showed just enough restraint not to send the man he was hanging on to sprawling to the pavement, but he did shove him forward so he nearly lost his balance. His dignity obviously insulted, the pudgy-featured man drew himself up, tucked his shirt back in, which had been disheveled by Bentley's rough handling, looked down at his left sleeve, which was splattered with blood, and shot an angry glance at Bentley, who remained by his side. The medic was already up by Bentley's side.
"It can wait," Bentley snapped.
The medic looked over at the civilian.
"That's my blood on him," the sergeant said sharply.
"Just who the hell are you?"
the civilian cried, voice a bit quivery, but Scales ignored him.
"Sergeant Major Bentley, are you hit?"
"I'll be all right, sir. It can wait."
Scales glanced to the medic.
"Don't see anything arterial, sir. I guess it can wait a few minutes."
"Fine, then."
The civilian cleared his throat to try to interrupt, but Scales continued to ignore him.
"Report, Sergeant. What was that shooting about?"
"This man here had a bodyguard who decided to take issue with my presence. He fired first." There was a pause.
"So I killed him."
He said so as if it were just a typical day's work, and Scales nodded. "A lot of others around. You'll see in a minute. I had to aim for the center of his body, didn't want any stray shots to get someone else."
"He murdered my man again," Scales cut him off.
"Let the medic tend to your wounds, Sergeant. Thank God you are safe."
At last, he turned back to the civilian.
"You are damn lucky my sergeant was able to walk back. Otherwise, it would have gone very badly for you and a lot of others. Do you read me?"
That caught the man off guard.
"Now you can talk. Who are you and what is your position?"
As he spoke, he took a step forward, hands balled up and resting on his hips. John had seen this more than once when his friend wished to convey a very strong, "don't mess with me" attitude. The civilian nervously cleared his throat.
"I'm Richard Pellegrino, head administrator of this facility."
"And this facility is?"
"Site A."
"I already know that," Bob snapped. "What is it now?"
Pellegrino hesitated, looking around at all those who were gazing at him.
"Who the hell are you to come bodging in here like this, slaughtering my security team?"
"You are answering the questions, not I. And you'd better answer me now, Mr. Pellegrino. I've got over 200 troopers outside who are very pissed off. I've got a full battalion airlifting here within the hour. I have the assets. Maybe you know who I am, my command, and what I can bring to bear. Do you realize that, Mr. Pellegrino?"
Pellegrino's gaze drifted to Scales' name tag. He hesitated and then looked back up at him.
"Why are you here? This position is not part of your command."
"It is part of my command now, and you are answering the questions. Therefore, my question, who are you and why are you here?"
His voice rose as he snapped out the last few words.
"Like I said," he began.
"Like I said, sir," Sergeant Bentley interjected sharply, still standing by Pellegrino's side while a medic was cutting open his sleeve to examine his wound.
Pellegrino cast a sidelong glance at the sergeant, who was still holding on to his .45 with his good hand, and then back to Scales.
"Like I said," he paused for a few seconds. "Sir, I am the head administrator for Site R."
"And Site R is?"
Pellegrino hesitated, which provoked Sergeant Bentley to pivot slightly. The .45 was still down at his side, but the threat was apparent.
"Answer General Scales completely," Bentley directed, articulating each word slowly and clearly. "We already know this is Site R. What is this place for now, today, Mr. Pellegrino, and no more game-playing?"
"It is a designated civilian emergency relocation center," Pellegrino finally replied, his voice barely above a whisper, as if conveying a great secret.
"Sir,"
Bentley again interjected.
"Sir,"
Pellegrino whispered, head slightly lowered.
"Then let's take a look at this emergency relocation center, shall we?"
"You can't," Pellegrino cried. "This facility has the highest level of security requirements, which I doubt you are qualified for. I am ordering you to turn around, leave now, and we can just call what happened a tragic mistake that I won't report."
Bob looked at him with absolute contempt.
"My security clearances existed long before you most likely crawled out of your frat house at some Ivy League hole. I've put up with shits like you for over 40 years, but not this day. If you want to debate it further, look around you. These men with me have as much security clearance as I do after the hell they've been through for the last 2.5 years, and every right to see what is down at the end of that road."
Pellegrino started to bluster, and Bob, contempt obvious, stepped past him.
"Someone dragged this bastard along," he snapped.
John, who had remained silent throughout the exchange, could not help but smile as Pellegrino was shoved to one side, a trooper grabbing hold of him by his collar and pushing him along. He had endured far too many like him during his brief stint at the Pentagon, some of them in uniform, who were just ticket-punching their way up the career ladder, and to hell with what was actually right.
or how many got hurt or even died as a result of their actions. The tunnel began to widen out. The troopers keeping pace with Bob along either side advanced with weapons raised, but not positioned to fire, but could do so swiftly if need be. If there was a danger around the corner, Bob did not seem to show the slightest concern. Walking down the middle of the paved road that leveled out and then went into a curving turn to the left at the bottom. Half a dozen troopers ahead of him reached the corner where the road turned left and came to a stop, raising weapons and shouting at someone unseen to drop their weapon and keep their hands visible. Bob motioned for the trooper pushing Pellegrino along to bring him forward.
"Now listen carefully, Mr. Pellegrino. Do you have more armed personnel around that bend?"
He hesitated, and again Sergeant Bentley was menacingly by his side. He could only nod.
"Then you go forward and tell them to lay their weapons down and come out with their hands up, that the fight is over and no one gets hurt. But if one of my troopers gets shot, Sergeant Bentley, or my friend John Matherson here, will gladly put one into you. The fight is over, Pellegrino. Let's make sure no one else gets hurt."
The thoroughly frightened administrator was shoved forward. He cautiously advanced the last few dozen yards, turned in the middle of the road illuminated by several floodlights, and squeaked out a command for those waiting on the far side to give up. What sounded like an argument started until Pellegrino shrieked out that they were outnumbered and everyone would die if they didn't surrender immediately. Seconds later, the first men and women of what John hoped was a final line of defense emerged, hands over their heads. Bob's troopers, weapons pointed high but still aimed in their direction, shouted out for them to move up the road on the double. Several dozen emerged, and as they were moved up the road, John could see the looks of fear. It was the medic who was trying to follow Bentley and work on him who helped diffuse the tension, walking in among them, offering reassurances, announcing that if any were hurt, they should fall out and she would take care of them. Otherwise, they should just keep moving up the road toward the exit. To John's amazement, one of them was actually smoking a cigarette, the scent of it wafting around him as they passed him.
A cigarette? Here? Just what kind of place is this, really?
"Any more?" Bob shouted.
A trooper at the very front of the ground turned, looked back, and replied with a hand gesture that all were cleared, but John could see there was a look of confusion from the other troopers who were standing at the bend in the road.
"Let's see if all of this was worth it," Bob said softly, starting out again.
Whatever they were about to see, John could not get out of his mind that his friend Lee was dead. Whatever they were to find, was it worth Lee's death? And then he turned the corner of the road, dug half a mile down into a mountain, and came to a stop in silent amazement. The underground cavern, if it could be called that, was illuminated nearly as bright as day and seemed to stretch off into infinity. The road, which had broadened out into four lanes as it went through the curve, emptied into a vast, open underground chamber, the road just continuing straight on until it was actually lost to view. There was a turn off to the right. An illuminated sign overhead announcing all entering had to first report for decontamination and security clearance. Bob ignored it, and up at the front with his troopers just pressed straight on, Bentley dragging Pellegrino along. The ceiling overhead arced more than 30 feet high. The spread of the cavern from his left to right was at least several hundred yards or more. The broad street was actually lined with barracks. World War II-era wooden barracks, row after row, each two stories high, and strangely, even topped with shingled roofs, interspersed with curved aluminum Quonset huts. At regular intervals, natural stone pillars rose from the floor to the ceiling to support the vast mountain overhead, so that the interior almost looked like some strange, surreal military cathedral. All stood in amazement. Except for Bob, who looked around, hands on his hips.
"Like I told you, John," he said softly, "I was here once, more than 25 years ago, as part of a drill. This was designed in the 1950s to be the fallback position for the Pentagon in the event of nuclear war. The barracks you see laid out down this road, it's actually called Main Street, were left over from World War II. After the place was hollowed out, it was felt that the cheapest and easiest thing to do was just build these. We still had hundreds of them as surplus, prefabricated and sitting in a warehouse a couple of hours away. No weather here, no termites. They'll stand 100 years or more. Off to the right, there used to be a motor pool, even used to have a couple of old Sherman tanks down here, rigged up as earth movers if we had to dig our way out of a nuke hit close by. There even used to be old-style electric golf carts for driving around inside. I think that was Ike's idea.
100 yards or more down Main Street, a small crowd had gathered.
"How many are here now?" Bob asked, looking back at Pellegrino.
"Who?"
"Civilians, damn it!"
Again a hesitation. "About 1,500, maybe 2,000. Some leave at times, and others are brought in." A brief pause, and with Bentley glaring at him, he finally added, "Sir?" The man's features had gone to nearly purple. His knees were shaking, and with a moan he slowly sank to the ground. The medic ran up to him, knelt down, felt for his pulse, and then looked up at the general. "Might be his heart, sir."
"Given what I think is here," Bob said softly, "I have to ask, what heart?"
He then announced, "Shoulder all weapons. These are civilians here. Unless he dies on us, drag him along." He gazed down coldly at Pellegrino.
"Which way to the command center?" he snapped,
and the ailing man pointed straight down Main Street. He set off with a purposeful stride, right up the middle of the main street, troopers, with weapons shouldered, as ordered, flanking to either side. John trailed along behind him, his friends Reverend Black, Maury, Forrest, Kevin, and Grace, who had disobeyed John's orders to stay behind and had caught up with the group and was still obviously in shock over Lee's death, followed behind Bob. They passed several of the wooden barracks, relics of what seemed another age. The paint was peeling from the wooden sides, but other than that, they seemed well tended. There were even nameplates tacked to doors. John slowed as he passed a Quonset hut on his left. There was a single name tag tacked to the door. He recognized the name, the same as on the personal emails that Linda had snatched out of the ether and which had finally led them to this place. Surely it couldn't be. As he stared at the nameplate, similar to the types of nameplates set in front of an officer's home on a military base, the door cracked open, an anxious young face looking out, a girl in her early teens at most, still gangly like a young colt. He smiled at her, and a flicker of a smile creased her slender face as she nervously brushed back an errant wisp of reddish hair. John stopped, his friend staying with him.
"Are you here to arrest us or something?" she asked.
He shook his head and gestured toward the front porch as if requesting permission to approach. She hesitated, nodded, and opened the door wider. He caught a glimpse of inside the barrack. Though the exterior was of World War II vintage, the interior looked something like a typical living room. A sofa, several chairs, and what appeared to be the back of an old-style television from 30 or more years ago. "Don't worry, young lady. There was a misunderstanding, but it's been settled. You're perfectly safe." He spared a quick glance back down Main Street. Bob had gone far ahead of him, surrounded by the troopers who had entered with him. John looked over his shoulder. His friends, however, had lingered behind, waiting for him out on the street. Grace was still with him, and it was she who broke the tension.
"Hi, my name is Grace," she announced in a warm, friendly voice,
and she simply stepped past John, advancing up a step onto the porch and extended her hand. The nervous smile on the young girl's face within the hut broadened slightly. She opened the door wider and took a step out, reached forward and politely shook Grace's hand.
"You sure everything is okay?"
the girl asked.
"We heard gunshots."
"We?" John asked.
"I live here with my mother and 2 kid brothers. The emergency siren went off. Our teacher told us to go to the shelter, but I ran home to get Buster before going to the shelter area, because sometimes we're in there for a day or two, and I can't sleep without Buster, and then I heard shooting."
"Who's Buster?" John asked. She hesitated, a bit embarrassed.
"It's okay,"
Grace said softly. The girl reached behind her and then produced a stuffed bear, obviously well-worn from constant loving attention, and her features turning red with embarrassment. The gesture,
The sight of her holding the stuffed bear struck John like an electric shock, and he lowered his voice. "That's okay, young lady. My daughter had a friend like him named Rabs." He could barely get the words out. Among his friends, there was no one who did not know about Rabs, his daughter's beloved stuffed companion, who sat on the windowsill in the sunroom and watched over her grave, and which John had gone back into his burning home to retrieve, more cherished to him than any other memory of the past. Maury came up to John's side. "You're about the same age as my son, who is 11," he said. "He won't admit it, but he has a friend like yours, a panda named Pandy that sits on his nightstand." "It's okay, young lady."
"I'm 12. My name is Laura."
"We're pleased to meet you, Laura," John interjected. "Don't be anxious. Everything is okay now. Just a misunderstanding and no one was hurt. We're just visiting here."
"That's good,"
Laura replied, still obviously a bit rattled.
"When I heard the shooting and I wasn't in the shelter area, I went to the far corner of the room and curled up behind the sofa with Buster as we were drilled to do and waited for the all clear, but I haven't heard the all clear."
"I think it might be broken," Grace replied. "They should have sounded it by now."
"Should I go to the shelter?"
she asked.